story. To sit around a table and hear somebody tell stories about their childhood, I think, is one of the cool things we get to do. To be in a Bible class and hear the stories of the Bible and of Jesus and Paul and all the other people that we know so well, to hear their stories told, is one of my favorite things to do. To probably swap a few stories of my own is always entertaining. And the early church likes to do the same thing. They like to tell the stories. You can go back to a few psalms that will go through the whole history of Israel. Psalm 78 kind of being the biggest one of them. And they'll tell the story of how God delivered and how God rescued and how God saved and how Israel sometimes fails, but God always kicks back in. And what's weird is we have a period where we don't get many stories. In fact, during that period, there are really three stories that are told in about a 30-year period. And we're going to look closely at one of them and then refer back to another one. But it's the story of Jesus from birth to 30. See, most of us know the stories of when Jesus starts off his ministry. You know, he begins his ministry there in Galilee, and he starts working there, and he attracts this group of disciples, and they work their way through the northern part of Israel, and then eventually winding up in Jerusalem, and there he gives his life and is resurrected so that we can follow him. But there's this 30-year gap in the story of Jesus, minus one thing. And what I find kind of interesting is the early church wrestled with this. So during the first couple hundred years, the early church is looking at Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and they say, we get this birth story of when Jesus is born in Bethlehem, and we get the temple story when Jesus is being given a sacrifice for, when he's still an infant. And then we get this story of Jesus in the temple, but nothing else. And so the early church starts to invent stories. And some of the stories are kind of entertaining, but they're just mythological. You know, my favorite one is I'm almost 100% positive that this didn't happen, because I don't think Jesus would have made the mistake. But remember, Jesus, the way they tell the story is the son of Joseph the carpenter, and he cuts the board too short. And his dad says, Jesus, you cut the board too short. And Jesus says, I got it. And he just pulls the board out 6 more inches. The church wanted to invent stories. They wanted to say, how do we celebrate this Savior where we know so little about him? But what I find interesting is the two stories that they tell us outside of the birth narrative of Jesus in the Gospels revolve around the temple. And they revolve around Jesus being at home with God. We're going to look at both of those in pieces this morning. The beauty about these stories, though, is they're not stories. We kind of live in an age where if I say I'm going to tell you a story, that might be true and it might not be true. The beauty of the stories we're going to see today are not fictitious stories invented about how Jesus could make a board longer, but they're stories that the gospel writers have researched to say, here's what we know to be true. And it reflects on Jesus wanting to be home with God. So let's start with the second story before we get to the first story. So here is what we have recorded. When Joseph and Mary had done everything required by the law, they returned to Galilee into the town of Nazareth. We'll come back to that statement in a second. The child grew and became strong and was filled with wisdom, and the grace of God was on him. Every year, Jesus' parents went to Jerusalem for the festival of the Passover. When he was 12 years old, they went up to the festival according to the custom. After the festival was over, while his parents were returning home, the boy stayed behind in Jerusalem, but the parents were unaware of it. Thinking he was in their company, they traveled on for a day, and then they began looking for him among their relatives and friends. When they did not find him, they went back to Jerusalem to look for him. After 3 days, they found him in the temple courts, sitting among the teachers, listening to them and asking them questions, and everyone who heard him was amazed at his understanding and his answers. When his parents saw him, they were astonished. His mother said to him, "Son, why have you treated us like this? Your father and I have been anxiously searching for you." Jesus asked, "Why were you searching for me? Didn't you know that I had to be in my father's house?" But they didn't understand what he was saying. So Jesus went down to Nazareth with them, was obedient to them. But his mother treasured all of these things in her heart. Okay, so this is our one adolescent story of Jesus. And to be honest, he's 12. He's not even quite an adolescent yet. It's this one story that we have probably told in Bible class, and we have told at VBS, and I'm not sure where Luke gets this story. My guess is Luke gets this story straight from Mary. Remember, at the very beginning of Luke's gospel, he's saying, I'm writing this to you, and I've researched it, and I've thought it all out, and I've got all these stories put together for you. And I'm guessing that he got this story from Mary. But it's one of those stories that I find pretty intriguing. Jesus is going to reveal his identity. Now, he doesn't reveal his identity to the sake of standing up as a 12-year-old and saying, I am future Messiah. He doesn't make these bold claims of what he's going to do through the cross. And he doesn't start to make bold claims at 12 that there's going to be a resurrection and that the world is going to be forever changed by it. But he's going to make one important statement that says, didn't you know that I would be in my Father's house? Now, my guess is, if you are a parent, you can relate to this story. So let's kind of maybe put it in the context of what they would be going through, and you could see maybe how it might relate to moments when you've lost your child in Walmart or Albertsons or Sam's or something like that. But what you would do is when you went to Jerusalem for Passover, from whatever town you lived in, you would go as a group. So you've got a large group that is coming from Nazareth. Nazareth is not a very big town. Jerusalem is. And so you've got this little small group that is coming from Nazareth, and they would travel as a band. So imagine we are the merry band of people going to Jerusalem for the Passover. Do we really want our kids around us for the 5 days it would take to get from Nazareth to Jerusalem? Of course not. We want them playing and having fun and doing their thing, and we don't want to be barking at them all the time. So you would kind of have a group of kids that would basically be in the middle, and there'd be parents in the front and parents in the back, and they would make this pilgrimage, and when they got to the place where they'd stop for the night, you'd go to the middle. Just like you're going to go pick up your kids in a few minutes at children's worship, you would go to the middle and you would say, okay, where are my kids? You'd gather your kids, you'd take your kids back to your tent, you'd put them to sleep for the night. And that's exactly what is happening in the story. And so what we have unfolding on the journey back is they have assumed that Jesus is with the mass of kids in the middle of the group playing and having a great time. And it's time to put the kids to bed. And they go into the middle of the walkway and they look for Jesus and know Jesus. And you've been there, right? My guess is every parent who's ever been a parent has lost their kid somewhere. I remember losing Jonah in Walmart, and I don't go to Walmart for that very reason now. I'm still petrified that I'm going to lose something in Walmart. But I remember losing him in Walmart, and Nikki sent me to go get something, and for the life of you, I couldn't tell you what that was, but I've got Jonah with me, and I'm looking at something, and he slips off, and Dad is an anxious soul anyway, kind of like Mary's going to be in a few minutes. And I'm thinking, where on earth is this boy? And I start looking and I start looking. And it takes me about 10 minutes before I finally find my child. And I remember doing exactly what I think Mary does. Remember when Mary finally finds Jesus? Remember, they've been looking for Jesus for 3 days. This isn't 10 minutes in Walmart. This isn't them announcing on the speaker saying, we've lost a child. If you're a child who's lost, come see. You know, they were desperate. They've been searching a town, and Jerusalem is probably the size of a city like Lubbock with more people. So imagine you've spent 3 days all over the city of Lubbock trying to find your kid. And then when you do, you're going to be a little tense. My guess is Jesus doesn't get very many gritted teeth lectures from his mom, but I guarantee this one was through gritted teeth, because we've all been there, right? I mean, even if our kid got lost and it wasn't the kid's fault for wandering off, maybe we got a little distracted and before we know it, we were the one who moved off. But what happens is Mary finds Jesus and through gritted teeth is basically saying, why have you done this to us? Where have you been all this time? And my guess, her voice probably cracks in the middle of it. But what Jesus is going to do is he's going to make it clear that this whole time, he was in the first place she should have looked. Didn't you know? Didn't you know that I would be in my Father's house? So the whole time he's been in his father's house, these 3 days, Luke kind of phrases it kind of interesting. It's almost like he starts off asking questions, but before you know it, he's participating in discussion, and he's asking the questions. And so you see Jesus, who is at this age where he's starting to find his identity. And again, what Jesus knows at 12, I don't want to try to fathom how much of the story of what's going to happen in 18 years with his ministry that he understands at that point. But I know he understands his calling for sure, because he knows this is his father's house. And he's starting to figure out his identity. Okay, don't you love watching your children figure out their identity? I mean, they start off as these little kids that all they need is you. And they get to about 3, maybe 2.5 to 4.5, and you want to give them back. Let's just tell the truth. So they're at that stage where they're figuring things out, and they're starting to understand who they are, and they're piecing things together. And then you get to probably my favorite age. My favorite age was about 5 to 10 or 11 or so, and they're starting to get their personality, and they're starting to get their little quirks, and they're starting to get their humor and the way they do things. And then they get to be teenagers, and you want to give them back again. And then you get them about 25, and they have finally figured out who they are. And the parent in us looks at that, and we sit back, and hopefully we celebrate it. And we think back on that journey of when they drove us nuts when they were 3, and we think back on those times when we lost them in Walmart, and we think back on those times when we had to have that discussion about grades and doing your best in school, and we think about those moments teaching them how to drive in town, and we think about all of those things that have happened on the course of life, and all of those interactions that happen with God and God's people. And we see how that led to the identity of our child. I think that's what's happening here, is Mary is figuring out the identity of her child. She's figuring out that Jesus is more than just the son of Mary and Joseph. At least that is the thought of most of the people around him. They're figuring out he's going to be something important, and he's about his father's business. I love what John says in John chapter 1, and this is part that Robert didn't read. Yet all who did receive him, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. Children not born of natural descent, nor of human decision or a husband's will, but born of God. So we know then the story that we can quote so well, usually around Christmas, but that's probably the wrong time to tell that story. It's the whole time to tell the story of Jesus being the will and born of God. But in the midst of all of that, he's saying, now here's our identity. That we can receive him. That we can believe in his name. That we then become those who can call him Father. We're his children. And that's our identity. Okay, we use that phrase, we exist to know Jesus and to make him known. Okay, maybe I have this wrong. I don't think so, because I helped figure that little phrase out. I think part of what we want to be as a church is, how do we tell our kids the story of Jesus and have that be their identity? How do we help parents raise kids? How do we help families? How do we help singles? How do we help older people? How do we help all of those in our presence to know Jesus and then to be willing to proclaim him? Because when we know him and when we proclaim him, we have found our identity in him. Okay, my identity is not just husband of Nikki, father of Jonah, son of Kevin and Judy. Now that may describe me, and those are pivotal things that go on in my life, and those things matter. Kind of like the place I work, and maybe the place I live, and what I do for fun. Those things help form my identity, but my identity is found first and foremost, hopefully like Jesus, about my Father's house. Not because I'm the preacher. I'm in my Father's house learning and asking questions and trying to figure things out and to learn more what it means to be God's person, because that's my true identity. More than father, more than husband, more than son, more than grandchild, more than grandpa someday, more than friend to all of you. My identity is found in Christ. And I want every kid who runs through this place to find their identity in the same place. So let me give you a couple things this morning. A little bit from this story, a little bit from the story that appears right before that. So how do we help our children find their identity in Jesus? How do we help them? Because if that's our goal, if we want more than anything else our children to be followers of Jesus, how do we do that? Well, here's what I learned from the stories of Mary and Joseph. The first thing is that they dedicated their child to the Lord. Okay, now they do it because it is the command of the law. But I love how they do it. So we get this story a little earlier in Luke. When the time came for the purification rites required by the law of Moses, Joseph and Mary took him to Jerusalem to present him to the Lord. As is written in the law, every firstborn male is to be consecrated to the Lord. Then notice verse 24, and to offer a sacrifice in keeping with what the Lord said in the law, a pair of turtle doves or two young pigeons. Maybe one interesting note, the fact that they are only doing a pair of doves or of young pigeons shows that they are poor as church mice. Because you had some options, and this was the option for the poor. And so you've got Mary and Joseph now, and Jesus is a baby, and they are bringing him into Jerusalem to go through this rite of purification to basically say, we're redeeming this child in the eyes of God, and it's so ironic to me that they are going to redeem the Redeemer. I mean, the one who's going to redeem us in a few years is the one they are here to redeem. And they're bringing Jesus before the priest, and they're making this offering of all that they've got, and they're saying, you now are consecrated, which is good Jewish speak for you now belong to him. From the moment I found out that I was going to be a dad, my prayer has been twofold. May he belong to God, and may whoever he meets in this life that he spends the rest of his life with, may they belong to God. And I started that prayer in a hammock in Brazil when I found out we were pregnant. Well, we weren't pregnant. Nikki was. Well, I guess I was there. I gained all the weight. But back to a different story. So that from the beginning, those were the two things that were so central to all that I prayed for. Okay, my prayer has changed now. And my prayer has changed for your kids. Not only do I want your kids to meet the right person when they're ready to get married, not only do I want your kids to be strong in the Lord, but I want them to be mighty in the kingdom. Okay, I hear older people every now and then say, what's the church going to be like in a while? That's why you pray the prayer, may they be mighty in the kingdom. That's why when you're holding that baby or when you're holding that grandchild or when you're working the nursery and you're holding somebody else's kids or you're working in Journeyland and you're help taking roll and doing memory verses or maybe you're teaching or maybe you're helping with the youth group and you're doing a Devo at your home or maybe you're leading the mission trip or maybe you're doing one of the hundreds of things we do for our kids and our families, I hope your prayer through all of that is may they be mighty in the kingdom. Because I found that when I started praying not just about them belonging to God and finding the right person, when I started praying, may they be mighty in the kingdom, it changed the way I parented. Because if this is the goal I haven't set, I don't want him to be the quarterback and I don't want him to be the world's smartest man. What I want him to be is mighty in the kingdom, and whatever it takes to get him from here to there, that's what matters. And Mary and Joseph dedicate their child to God. We've got a mama here that does her prayers every night with her kids. And the only reason I know this is because that mama had her kids at a ski trip once. And as she was sitting down on that little bunk bed where they were sleeping, they read the story and then they had a little prayer. And then she would hold each child's hand and say, "You belong to God. You're his. No matter what else happens in your life, you are his." Okay, that mama's always got a special place in my heart, and I hope all of us are doing that. Whether it's our child or our grandchild or a kid in church, to be able to say those words, "You are gods. So they've dedicated him. The second thing is, I believe they modeled devotion. So throughout chapter 2, Mary and Joseph, I see them as devout believers in God. I mean, Mary's already been talked about to in volumes, really, in chapter 1 and the beginning of chapter 2. And we get this idea of Joseph being this stable factor and this just honest-to-goodness good guy. And so we're going through all this early story of Jesus, and we see that they believe and trust in him. Okay, let me think of how gently I want to say this. Your kids need to see you love your God. Your grandkids need to see you love your God. When I do marriage counseling, often if they've got younger kids, I encourage them, embarrass your kids, you know, kiss your spouse right in front of them so they go, ooh, and they do all those cringes because they're going to learn about marriage from watching you and how you love your wife or your husband. They're going to learn about God by watching how you love your God, by how you have centered everything around him, by how you have said, here is our house, and the centerpiece of our house is what God has done through Christ to save us and build his church. And I think that's exactly what Mary and Joseph do, is they say, here is who we are, and here are the mighty acts of God. And I believe they are good Jewish parents who will constantly tell the stories. I love this little line that appears in Deuteronomy chapter 11. And we don't hardly ever read Deuteronomy, but there's this little section. Fix these words of mine in your hearts and minds. Tie them as symbols on your hands. Bind them on your foreheads. Teach them to your children. Talk about them when you sit at home and when you walk along the road, when you lie down and when you get up. Write them on the door frames of your houses and on your gates, so that your days and the days of your children may be many in the land the Lord swore to give your ancestors, as many as the days that are in heaven above. Okay, so what Moses is saying, okay, parents, okay, grandparents, and you had a nuclear family in Israel that you might have 4 or 5 generations that all still lived in the same house or the same group of houses around each other. And what Moses is saying is we're going to fix our kids' eyes on what is the most important. And so we're going to tell the stories and we're going to tell the mighty deeds of God and we're going to live our life before them like God matters. Okay, I am afraid, I'm considering asking my son this question this weekend. I don't know if I want to hear his answer. I hope it's the answer. He doesn't watch us anymore. But I want to say, what did you learn the most from watching your parents? Okay, now I don't know what his answer is going to be. I hope his answer will be, I learned what it meant to follow God. Because that was my prayer going in. And that was what we tried our best, even as faulty, messed up people, to model that in our home. But I hope that's what he saw. And I hope that's what your kids see. The statistics are interesting. And I don't know how you quite get the parameters to know when it's truly modeled and when it's not. But statistics show that when we have modeled devotion, which I think means we are actively involved in the call of God, children, to the most part, are likely to follow in those steps. But when we are churchgoers every now and then, our kids will be churchgoers every now and then. Again, statistics can be manipulated, and I doubt that all of those tell all of the stories in this room, but there's got to be a kernel of truth to that. That when we live it and we model devotion and we let God be the center of everything that we are, hopefully that passes on to our children. Okay, and then the last thing. I think Mary, and maybe at least to some degree Joseph, were ready to hurt. There's one more story. They're going to run into a woman named Anna. They've met a guy named Simeon, who's an old man who's thrilled that this baby has been born. But they're going to run into this lady named Anna. Simeon blessed them and said to Mary, his mother, this child, let's tell Simeon's story first. I'm jumping ahead. This child is destined to cause the falling and the rising of many in Israel, and to be a sign that will be spoken against, so that the thoughts of many hearts will be revealed, and a sword will pierce your own heart too, your own soul too. Okay, that had to be haunting for Mary. Here she is. She has come out of the temple. They have presented their turtle doves to the Lord, and they're walking now out of the temple with this child in their arms, and they are greeted by this old man Simeon, and he starts off with these great lines. Here's what this child is going to do. And I'm going to paraphrase a little bit, and it's going to break your heart too. And then one of the last stories we see of Mary is at the cross. In fact, the last story we see of Mary is where Jesus is at the cross. Jesus is on the cross, and Mary is there with who we assume to be John the apostle, or eventual apostle. And Jesus will look down at John and say, "Behold your mother," which is Jesus' way of saying, "I'm not going to be here anymore. You take care of her. She's now yours." And can you fathom the hurt? I mean, even though you've known from your teenage years, when you were told by an angel that you would have a child, and you're not much older than that now, and you're in the midst of a temple, and you got an old man who's cradling this baby saying, "This is going to pierce your own soul too," and then you start the ministry of Jesus, and you watch what he goes through, and you watch how he's treated, and you watch the story of Calvary, and before you know it, you're on the foot of the cross, broken. I think Mary was prepared early to hurt. There are going to be moments when we're parenting where it's going to hurt. There are going to be those moments when our kids will come home from school and they will have failed miserably. And it's going to hurt you. And there are going to be those moments when you get the call at midnight and they were doing something they shouldn't have been doing. It's going to hurt. And there are going to be moments when they're sick, and there are going to be moments when they're under pressure, and there are going to be moments when they're bullied, and there are going to be moments when life doesn't go the way it wants, or they want, or you want, and life is hard, and there are going to be those moments, and the story of Jesus and the story of Mary just reminds me that when it happens to us, not only should we be ready to hurt with them, but we should be ready to remind them of God. Because if we want our children to choose God, then we got to let them go through that. We got to let them find their answers in the only place that matters. We got to be willing to let them face the challenges and face the hardships and face the failures that sometimes come so that they might turn to the right places. And part of the right place is us, but the full right place is the Father. And I think that's what Mary does. Then we get this little lady named Anna. Here's what the story says about Anna. There was a prophet named Anna, the daughter of Phanuel of the tribe of Asher. So Simeon has given his prophecy, and now it's Anna. She was very old, and she had lived with her husband 7 years after her marriage, and then was a widow until she was 84. She never left the temple, but worshipped night and day, fasting and praying. Okay, notice the story. Coming up to them, so the them is Mary, Joseph, Jesus, and maybe Simeon is still in the circle. Coming up to them at that very moment, she gave thanks to God and spoke about the child to all who were looking forward to the redemption of Jerusalem. Okay, Luke starts telling the story of their journey to Jerusalem in this second section of saying, we're on our way to Jerusalem to redeem the child. And he's going to end this narrative by saying, here is the true redemption. And that it's this sweet little 84-year-old woman who when Jonah was a baby, we would have these contests of which 80-year-old woman had been hugging on him the most. And so we would smell him to see which perfume we could smell. And we'd say, well, that's so-and-so, and that's so-and-so, and that's so-and-so. Here's this 84-year-old woman hugging on Jesus as a little baby and saying, he's going to be the redemption. we sing a song, and I shouldn't give my bias out. It is my very favorite communion song. That doesn't mean we have to lead it every single time. But there is a Redeemer, Jesus, God's own Son. And I don't know if part of Anna's little thing with Jesus is maybe she broke into a little Hebrew song, but if she did, it would have been the Hebrew version of that. There is a Redeemer. Now, at that point, she could hold or at least touch that Redeemer in her hands. And now we hold that Redeemer up as our Savior, as the one who has always been and who will always be, as we saw in John chapter 1, but as the one who is the Son of God who came and lived just like we have to live and lived it perfect and died so that we could have life and we could be redeemed. That's the story I want my kids to know. And I hope that's the story we're teaching our kids at this place every single time we've got him in our arms. There is a Redeemer, Jesus, God's own Son. So we've got a song picked out. Wouldn't it have been nice if I'd have told Kent to lead that as our song? Sorry, Kent. We're going to sing a song. If you need me, I'll be at the front. Elders will be at each door.